Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 263, my conversation with Austin improviser Kit Brooks. But first, let me tell you about our sponsors. This episode of Yes But Why podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. You know, today I started listening to Revelation by Russell Brand. I just really prefer listening to books now. And it's not at all because I love the crap out of that man's voice. I mean, maybe, but... Go now to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. You'll get a free audiobook and access to hundreds of books and podcasts, all included with your membership. It's time. Get Audible. Yes But Why podcast is also sponsored by PodcastCadet.com. PodcastCadet.com is all about helping you find the right podcasting path for you. Connect with us now at PodcastCadet.com. Use promo code YBY20 and you'll get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. This week on Yes But Why, I chat with Austin improviser and educator Kit Brooks. In our conversation, we talk about Kit's deep study into how creativity and identity affect how we learn and how that rabbit hole led them to finding improv. Kit's breadth of knowledge on the way we process information was so fascinating. A great listen. I now present Yes But Why, episode 263, Kit Brooks on creativity, identity, and the way we learn. Enjoy.
Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah.
I was a dark child. a dark I read serial killer books. Like, I had this like anthology of serial killers, and I would write this like twisted emotional poetry. I was like 8 years old, like writing poetry about death was like the level. Like, my parents were concerned.
Were they?
They were kind of concerned, and I was like, it's fine, but I think it was the like. Because I was a pretty smart kid, like, I was gifted for the area that I was in, and so they were concerned about the darkness, but they were more concerned about, like, how good they felt it was for being, like, a 7 or 8 year old. And so that sort of, like, took over the whole conversation. Like, there was this whole thing with my art teacher who, like, thought that my parents had, like, written a poem I submitted.
Oh!
And had to, like, prove that, like, no, like... We get that, like, Elena's only 8, but, like, they definitely wrote this. So, I wrote very dark poetry as a child.
Oh, my God, I love it. So well written that the teachers were thinking you're plagiarizing. They're like, This has got to be Emily Dickinson. Find it in the annals. Yeah. There's, like, a librarian just checking.
And, of course, I'm, like, 8. And I have, like, no friends. And I'm like, it's just my soul.
Oh, man. I felt deeply and emotionally as well as a child, for sure. I was, they used to say I was, like, 5 going on 35. And I think that was true. I definitely think that was true. Do you think, like, you have, like, an old soul? Like, is that, I don't know if you even believe in that, but, like, I don't know
if it's, like, an old soul. I think I was just, like, I think I'm a person that has a really high level of emotionality, whether that's like genetic or not. So I feel things really deeply, more so than I think the people around me did. Mm-hmm. And so the way that I like managed that was through like, at the time, very dark poetry.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny that you say the feeling deeply thing, because I have recently come to realize that that's the superpower of creative people. That like the reason why people don't understand us and like think, you know, people are like, oh, can't you just do that when you work in a Geico? And you're like, I mean, I could, but here's the thing. This is my full soul I'm trying to express, right? And the other thing too is that like creative people tend to be like, you know, very emotional, feel things in a larger sense, like have, you know, a breadth of reactions. But I think that's to serve the art, right? That's because they need this deeper well, because there needs to be more that comes out of it than your average Joe. Average Joe, right. And man, I have thought about average Joe so much, this idea of like, what would it be like to have a manageable emotion? That being said, in the world of anxiety,
I think about
right
that
now,
a lot too.
Yeah. In the world of anxiety, though, I'm like, you know, maybe my emotionality, I'll take this versus having another like, because there's people who are not creative. I feel like what happened was non-creative people got a little adrenaline dose of all of our emotions. And instead of it just being our life and like who we are, they just get it as a punch in the face every once in a while. And they're like, no, not this many emotions exist in the world. And we're like, yeah, dude, they exist all the time.
They do.
And it's hard for them, you know, because it's just like a big, huge wave crashing over them as opposed to the constant ocean, right?
Yeah. It's so hard to like have empathy for someone else's experience that you aren't like privy to, right?
It is hard. It is hard. But I mean, I feel like that's my effort. As a creative. In my personal life, I could probably be better at it. But like in improv and as a teacher, that's always what I'm trying to do, is like figure out the way this person sees the world and try to help them move forward in it. Like whatever it might be, you know, like when I'm teaching improv, I'm usually teaching 101, and it's like I want to show them a magical world. Like, I'm like, hold on, guys. Let me tell you what happens. Wait.
Yeah.
You're not going to believe it, but you're going to make up a million ideas. And they're like, what? I can't even come up with one. And I was like, you got a million. You know what I mean? Like, and they don't know. They don't know they got a million. But then we tweak their perception a little bit, and they do, right?
Right.
But the beautiful thing about creative people, you and I, we have that perception open. You've had it open since you were a kid. So you're writing poetry. You're wide open to the world. Your parents, no offense to them, but they sound like normies. Like they're not really writing poetry, right?
They're normies.
Yeah, totally.
I love them.
My parents
are
also normies. Yeah, they didn't. They were always like, she's so dramatic. We're not sure why, right? that's why I was 5 going on 35, because they were like, is she just striking up a conversation with a random stranger and like holding her own? What is happening right now? But you know, how did it manifest for you? I mean, did people's weird reactions to it squash your creativity, or did you continue to like, you know, dress as Lydia Deetz in Beetlejuice and like really like amp it up throughout, you know, high school?
Yeah. Well, I did not dress like Beetlejuice because my mom gave me my sister's hand-me-downs. We lived in like rural Indiana, so it was like Goodwill clothes, right? Like I didn't have access to like Morticia Adams wardrobe.
Right.
I probably would have worn it if I had access to it. So I grew up in this under-resourced area, right? This rural area didn't have a lot of schools, and I was like a gifted kid. And so the solution to that from the school district was just to have me skip grades. And so I ended up okay. But so I think what happened for me creatively is that I put a lot of that on the back burner when I was given like more challenging work. And I like dove super deep. And like I was 13 and doing calculus was Whoa. Like the level of like kind of where I was. And so that was like where I was putting all my effort as a kid.
Yeah.
At that point.
Did you like being moved forward? Because I clearly judged the moment. You're like, no, I'm all right. It. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I was like, the principal had the idea to skip the first grade and the second grade, but the third grade that I skipped, I did. I was like, listen, I don't like this podunk cornfield town. I'm ready to be with like more nerds. There's no nerds in this town. I just didn't fit in, didn't have any friends. And like the last one, I was like, I'm just going to graduate high school early too. Like, it doesn't matter. I ended up graduating at 15 and going to college after that. Yeah, but I was all about it at the time. I was like, no one gets me. No one understands me.
Sure.
And so I'm just going to leave.
Great. So did you go to college at 15?
I did, yeah.
My gosh. Tell me about it.
Yeah, I went to this tiny tech school in southwestern Indiana called Rose Hulman that specializes in like science and engineering. And I started out as an engineering major, and then shifted to biology, because I just thought engineering was boring and science is more interesting. So that's why.
I hear you.
Yeah.
I was, signed up to be a bio major in college before, like, and I changed crying like the week before school started freshman year. Like, I was literally found the school because I had a great biology department, had taken all the placement tests, like was ready to be a science major. And then I had like a crisis and I was like, you know what? I'm going to do this. And they're like, the admissions was very, communicative. Like, I had like a person who was my main person who I talked to through the whole process. So I felt very close to them. So I called her and was like, I need to change my entire schedule to theater. And she was like, oh yeah. And I was like, yes, I'm going to be a drama major. She was like, okay, but all of the tests that you took literally mean nothing now. Like, you're not going to even take a science class as a theater major, even one. And I was like, doesn't matter. This is what I meant to do, and I'm going to do it. And she was like, okay. And I changed my whole schedule while my parents were out of the house. Like, I'm on the phone, like a real phone with like a curly.
Oh, yeah.
Thing. And I'm talking and I'm like, are they going to catch me? And they come in the door and I burst into tears. And I was like, I'm so sorry to disappoint you. I'm going to be a theater major. And they were like, yeah, that seems right. That's what we thought you were going to do. We were surprised by the whole bio thing. We were just rolling with it. We just were like, yeah, cool, bio.
That's so funny. I had that same moment of like, I was like in Walmart, like calling my parents, telling them I'd switched majors. And it was that same like level of anxiety. And I had only switched majors from engineering to science. And I was like, oh no, this is never going to work. And they had a lot of questions about like, how are you going to get a job and everything? Because engineering is like a guaranteed job. Sure. And they like, I guess, didn't understand how scientists got jobs. And I didn't end up getting a science job, but that is part of the story, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm totally into biology. Sometimes I'm sad I didn't just get a degree in it because, like, my theater degree is not helping anybody. But maybe my bio degree would equally not help me, but I would still maybe have other knowledge.
My bio degree is super helpful, and I'm a preschool teacher.
Yeah, well, that's probably helpful, yeah.
Yeah, we do lots of little experiments in our classroom. And some of the, oh my gosh, it's so wild, like, the way that we can incorporate it. So I've recently been teaching about the 10 plagues, like in preparation for Easter, Passover, teaching about the 10 plagues. And one of the plagues, the fifth plague, cattle disease, is actually thought to have been caused by anthrax. And so I was able to pull up a bunch of different pictures of like different microorganisms. And we talked about the different shapes that bacteria take and like how bacteria work and stuff like that. Yeah, that's like the level that I'm like, oh, I could take this science and give it to 3-year-olds.
You know what, though? I mean, I would never have believed it before I was a mom that like kids could comprehend that kind of stuff. But they really can. Like, we watch a show called Storybots with my 3-year-old, and it like tells. Yeah, it's an excellent educational show. I have learned so much. Right. And it's like, but he retains it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, he'll be like singing the song about the plane, you know, how it flies. And I'm like, This kid understands how a plane flies. He's three. Like, are you kidding me right now? Another reason why, like, we've been on planes before. And I was like, remember? It's like they sang about it. And he was like, oh, yeah, all right, great. Planes. Great. It's going to be wonderful. So he's, like, not nervous on planes because he, like, understands how it works, you know?
I'm That's like, so lovely. What?
Like, so, yeah, I mean, you're doing a service. There are a few of those kids in there are really as smart as can soak that up. And they'll use that later. They'll be bio majors someday and they'll be like, I don't know how I got interested in this. Now, you're in this college for science and engineering. Was that the like path you went on as you were the gifted kid skipping grades? Like you were a science gal just doing all the science fairs, winning them. They were the best.
Yeah, that was kind of like the what got translated to me as like, especially a middle schooler and a high schooler, was like that the arts weren't valued and the arts weren't a way to have a career for yourself. Yeah. And I was good at math and science. So like, obviously I'm good at that thing. That's a thing that leads to careers. That's the thing that I'm going to keep doing and focusing on. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I think I was a wildly independent child. And I just wanted to like be on my own, I wanted to be out and like make my own rules. And so the path to doing that required a career, which the arts could not provide. So I think that's why at the time in like, you know, middle and high school, it didn't seem viable and I didn't really focus on it.
Yeah. Nobody told me that or said not to do it. They definitely were like, well, there are other more responsible things you could do. But like you, I was a bit wild and also not, I don't know. I think everyone thought I would be responsible later. Like they were like, let her sow her wild oats. She's a crazy gal. She'll settle down. And then they were like, wow, she's still working in theater. That's super crazy. But you know, I mean, I hear that this idea that, you know, there's just nowhere to go. And you know, I'm glad that we're talking about it because a few people mention it and we kind of move forward. But I think it's an important thing for people who might be listening to this, who are like in maybe a town where there isn't any theater. And they're like, I really want to do this, but it just doesn't seem viable. It is. There's a big world out there and you never know where you can move that will have what you're looking for. And the beauty of it is that, you know, we're in a time like technologically and, you know, ability to move around the country ways where like any human being, wherever you live, you can go to another state if that state maybe has something cool you want to do, right?
Yeah, that's true.
You know, there's a lot of time, even in the recent past. I mean, our parents probably didn't feel so free to just move to somewhere else. You know, my parents both lived in the same state that they grew up in, right? So they didn't realize, you know, when I moved, it was like a big deal to my family, like my extended family, like, whoa, she's going to Texas. Oh! And I was like, now that I'm here, I realize like just how not that far away it is. Like, I'm like, eh, it's fine. It's quick. Whatever. I'm close. Yeah. You know, I'm not in Australia, you know, but
it's true.
You know, so it's interesting to see how that can affect people. Now, did that idea further internalize in you? Like you went to science and engineering college, but I note that you're not currently working in science. Like at what point was the breaking point for you where your wild independence that we've established really like showed you a different path?
It's interesting. It was an MS diagnosis, actually. So I was 17. I was a sophomore in college. It was the spring of my sophomore year and I woke up and I couldn't feel half of my body. And so I went to the emergency room, CT scans, spinal taps, MRIs, all sorts of stuff, you know, like a month and a half later. And I'm 17 with an MS diagnosis.
Whoa.
That'll put you somewhere.
Yeah, man. Yeah, that'll change your point of view right away.
Yeah, so I'm 17, halfway in college, trying to set up my ideal life, and then suddenly I'm spending all of my time Googling prognosis and symptoms and, like, not even finding anyone close to my age who's been diagnosed with this. In my, like, people were recommending, like, support groups, and I went to, like, one or two, and they were all people in their, like, 40s.
Oh, I legitimately thought you were going to say older. I personally, yeah. Of the people that I know who have gotten MS in their lives, they were in their 60s when they got them. So that's why, yeah. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Man, what a life change for you. What a, like, mental, like, explosion. Like, that is. Oh,
absolutely.
Oh, wow. So how did that change your perspective?
Yeah. So I think. Well, one, there was obviously a period that was not very fun for me.
Yeah.
I think I went through, like, a slew of really negative coping mechanisms that were not beneficial to my well-being, because I was dealing with all the emotions of being diagnosed with this chronic illness. And after I kind of sifted through those and was like, okay, well, I've still got to figure out how to have a life. Science didn't seem viable, because to me, I didn't know how long I would be able to, like, use my hands to do lab experiments, right? And things like that. And so I knew that I was still interested in biology. So I kept on with my, like, it was kind of that 2 year period of the last 2 years, and I'm like 18, 19. Where those 2 years of college were, like, filled with just, like, really negative behaviors that were not very supportive to my well-being. But at the same time, I was like, I'm going to finish college. I'm going to get a degree. And I, like, kept on my path and, like use negative coping mechanisms to support me in, like, finishing my degree program. And it was in my, like, senior year when I was doing my thesis that I kind of realized a path for myself. Because I had watched a TED talk on the effects of posture on learning, like, had been shared with me. And I'd been talking to one of my biology professors, and I decided to research that as my senior thesis. And so I looked at learning broadly, and instead of going at a micro level, which is what most of the people in my program were doing, you know, most of the people in my cohort were, like, researching mRNA and, like, looking at, like, biochemical reactions. And I took, like, the independent time to learn about learning and how people learn, which eventually led me to grad school, got a master's in education, and now I teach.
Oh, wow. Wow. So the, like, project of learning how people learn, which I'm super fascinated in, yeah. Like, the idea of how it soaks up into different people's brains. Now I'm, like, way more excited that you're teaching the 3-year-olds about bacteria because I'm like, ooh, she knows something I don't know. Oh my God, what is it? But yeah, so what an interesting point of view to go into a master's program for education, right? I feel like if you're going to go into a master's program for education, most people are, like, you know, trying to be the head of the union or like be an administrative, the department to work for the Department of Education for the U.S. or something. Like, I feel like, cause you don't have to get a master's in education.
Right.
So the people who are really getting into it in a big way.
Yeah.
So was it like psychology? Yeah. Yeah. Tell me about it. What was the vibe?
Yeah. So the program was, in learning sciences. So I, you know, realized I could research, and I still love doing research. And so I went into this program called Learning Sciences and learned all about the ways in which we see people learning in real world situations, and we see people being intrinsically motivated to learn. So everything from, like, how throwing a ball teaches a kid the basics of physics to how, gamers playing World of Warcraft teach themselves statistics so that they can figure out how to run their characters better. Like just all these ways in which people personalize their own learning and make meaning out of their lives, and how that supports them is really interesting. And it kind of led me, when I was in undergrad, I double majored in international studies, and I looked at the role of gender cross-culturally, because I was queer, so it was just my excuse to do queer theory research in a technical school, right? In
yeah,
like a science
school. Somebody needs to do the research.
Mm-hmm. So when I got to grad school and I started looking at the ways that identity affects how we learn and what we choose to study and what we have access to study. And that's really where I think I started to merge creativity back into my life. I took a whole course on the pedagogies of creativity, right? And I was finding out mostly that like all the ways that we use to teach things like math and science are very honestly like white coded, right? Like they're built for like one type of mind. And I happen to be someone that like that worked really well for, but I'm not the only person who like should be being served by learning institutions. And so I dipped more into my like creative life when I got to grad school in my early 20s so that I could learn how to use those kind of practices to like support all people who want to learn things.
Yeah. Man, I'm dying to know about this pedagogies of creativity and like what that means. Like that's
super... It was wild. I did a whole autoethnography project on spoken word poetry.
Oh, so when I mentioned slam poetry earlier, I saw your recognition. I thought maybe you're going to be like, so I'm a bit of a slam poet.
For a semester, I did spoken word poetry. Literally one semester, it was like my deep dive into spoken word poetry where I was reading, like, I read hip hop pedagogy. I read, you know, like all the research that was on it. And I would go to all the slams in town and I performed exactly one time. And then I reflected on it. And that was part of the research, right?
Oh, man. I like the idea, too, that it was like this deeply academic research into creativity that you were like, oh, wait, I remember now. I'm a creative person. Perhaps I should do poetry again. Yeah. Not a surprise that you got back into poetry. Was there any darkness to your spoken word? Did you perform when you were doing it or did you just like infuse yourself?
I did perform. You know, I think there was a little bit of darkness, not quite the same level. It was like, because when I was a kid, it was like trying to be Edgar Allan Poe, right?
Yeah, I mean,
But the stuff that I worked with more as an adult was trying to like process the mostly like the negative coping mechanisms that I had used, right? So like I have had an eating disorder for many years. And so the spoken word poem that I ended up performing was like the first time I'd ever talked publicly about being bulimic.
Creative people are a good crowd to share your deepest, darkest with, for sure. Nothing makes me want to tell you every secret of my life than a microphone and an audience. And I know that sounds insane. I'm sure you're like, no, there's a book about that.
I get it though. Yeah. It's not intimate. From at least from my perspective, it's like I'm in control. I'm choosing what to share. You have to listen because you're in the audience, but I can't even see you.
Man, I'd never processed it that way. I really appreciate your point of view because clearly you're a deeply educated point of view in this particular scenario. I had never thought about it. I am a super control freak. And I never thought about the idea that I was in control when I'm the person talking on the stage and that everyone has to. I mean, like, I get that I get attention. I like the attention. Everyone turns and looks at me. I'm like, oh, yeah. Hey, everybody. But I also like talking to large groups all at once. I like acting like there's just five of us in a room, especially when there's like 200. Listen, guys.
Yeah.
You know what's going to happen. But let me just tell you. Man, so fascinating. So after you get out of grad school and you're like raring to go, how are you manifesting as an adult? Because like you've had a tumultuous childhood during this, this story. There's a lot that's happened. And I'm pretty sure by the end of Masters in Education, are you even 20 at this point? I mean, like, how many years is a master's? Two, three?
Yeah. So true to character, I accelerated it and did it in 1 year. Because of course I did.
You're like, listen, I'm also still dealing with MS, but like, guys, could I just take 40 hours a day in classes? Is that fine?
It's ridiculous. I took like 15 and 18 like grad level credits at this, like, each semester. It was a wild time.
Whoa.
And so I think I was 22 when I graduated, because I had taken a year off to apply to master's programs and like lived with my parents and like helped my sister with the like birth of her second kiddo.
Oh, I thought you were going to say like graduate from high school and get her also out of the house. But no, she was older and she was having children. That's nice.
Mm-hmm.
That's nice. Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Which is, I think, where, like, the childcare kind of, because I realized that I, like, was really enjoyed working with kids when I was spending that, like, year-ish with my niece and nephew.
Well, plus, you meet some kids, and that definitely can inspire an interest in education, for sure.
Yeah.
Right? Because you're like, what are they telling them? Right? And then, so it makes total sense that you would then have been like, hold on, let me just deep dive into all education. I'll come back, sis, let you know what you need to know. Yeah. I'll give you a little crib sheet.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Now I feel like you need to write a book on, like, what's the best things you need to teach your kid. You'd be a billionaire if you wrote this book, by the way, because me and the moms, we buy the books. I'll tell you what.
Oh, yeah. I've been writing handouts for my parents in my classroom, and I'm having so much fun being like, and this is an activity that supports this domain of development, and this is how it supports.
Oh, my God. I want it. It's so crazy. Seriously,
so nerdy.
Make it a book, and I'll pay you money for it. That's, like, so... My brain does not work that way. Like, I'm a creative person. I can do lots of things. I can make adults happy and do things and make them take chances they would never take and talk to strangers, and I have lots of skills. But me and my child, I don't even know how to talk to them. I mean, aww. I try my best, but it's so hard to, like, just teach this tiny human, right? Like, I just don't know what to... So, yeah, I mean, I'm reading the books on this, that, and the other thing. I got, like... he's super into science, so I got all these science experiment books, and, you know, we're going through random science experiments, talking about stuff, and I'm like, does he even know what I'm saying? Like, as I'm like, you see the reason why this is working, and, you know, I don't know, but...
Well, he's three, so I imagine that you are doing plenty.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're doing, like... Being one-on-one with him, talking to him, is expanding his vocabulary. You're showing an interest in his interest and showing him that, like, his passions are valuable, right?
Yeah.
That's all that needs to happen at, like, three and four.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Appreciate it. If you just write a book that just says that,
I'd still be a billionaire. Like, he does not need to know any letters of the alphabet when he's three.
Oh, he knows all the letters of the alphabet.
Boom. It's already there.
I was like, no, letters and numbers were, like, number one. He, like, super got into them. He knows everyone. He even knows phonics. We've started watching.
That's fun.
We were trying to teach him speech therapy, so we watched these shows on phonics because we thought, well, if they say the sounds, then maybe that'll help him say them. So he would repeat with them, and that helped him talk. But now he, like, the other day we're driving down just wherever, taking a drive, and he's literally saying the sounds. Like, he's going, B. And I'm like, are you doing? And he went through, and I didn't want to push him, you know, because I know what it's like. I can't be the mom who's like, what's that you're talking about? And he'll stop immediately. So I'm just, like, overhearing, you know, I'm like turning the music down slightly so I can hear him. And he gets all the way through to the end. And I was just like, yeah, like, you did that. That's amazing. How do you know all those things and keep them in your brain?
Aww.
But, like, you know, I was just like super impressed with that kind of thing. So I think, you know, when you're talking about the math brains, you might have a math brain, right? There's a certain amount of like repetition gets in your brain and it works for some people. Though that being said, some creatives are like that. That's how they like memorize lines sometimes, repetition. Yeah.
It was funny as you were talking about phonics, the first thing that came in my head was like, oh, actually, just so you know, it's like typical for kids to struggle with certain sounds all the way up until age 7.
Oh, that is helpful. That makes me feel a lot better.
Yeah. Like, it's you know, you've got plenty of time.
Yeah. The mom community puts a lot of pressure on each other. There's a lot of push. I have a lot of very supportive moms, but I also have a lot of moms that are like, oh, well, see, you know, my child can do these equations. And I'm like, I don't know. No, I don't. We worked on maybe 1 + 1, but that was literally just to understand.
It's so funny because parents get these like they're like a little bit of a dopamine high off of this achievement that like we look at the research and see that it doesn't actually have an effect, you know, 20 years down the line. Right. Like there's this big push in early childhood for academic preschools, right? Parents are saying, my kid needs to learn all their letters. My kid needs to be able to write their name, et cetera, et cetera. And those kiddos who graduate from those programs, as opposed to play-based, child-centered programs, those kiddos in the academic programs have a little bit of an advantage in kindergarten that levels out by the end of first grade. And these kiddos have better socio-emotional outcomes 10 years later.
Yeah, like, interesting.
Again, here's the research.
No, you're like so fully researched. You like have it all. Like, I really appreciate that you're like using it. And like the fact that you did this deep dive on education in such a way is so just so amazing. It's so we are connected in the world through the comedy community, right? Mm-hmm. We became friends on one of the, you know, fun improv groups and connected with that. So after you get out of grad school and you are like, I know how everyone learns and how it works out, at what point and why did you end up involved in improv?
Sure. Yeah. So right out of grad school, I got a job for the summer as an inclusion counselor. So I was a summer camp counselor supporting kids with disabilities. And I was using some of the so it's funny because I learned about like the research behind improv before I'd ever really tried improv. so I'd like play, you know, like little improv games to like use as behavioral supports for my kiddos in the summer camp, but like had no idea what like improv comedy was at all. And so I moved to Austin with my nesting partner. So my nesting partner is a software developer. And so we moved down here because she got a job here. And I was like, I can teach anywhere. So after that summer camp ended, because she was getting her bachelor's degree, so it was just like a timing thing. So we both moved all the way to Texas from Indiana. And I started teaching, and I wanted... This is kind of an interesting story, actually. I did not take improv classes at first because I like to say that I took them because I wanted to be a better teacher, but it's kind of half the story. Really what happened was that I started volunteering at an organization that does improv classes for adults with disabilities. And so I started volunteering for this class, and the teacher was the first queer person I met in Austin. And I don't know if you know anything about queer culture in rural Indiana, but if you find a queer person, boom, best friends. Like, our college had a house like off campus that was the queer house. It was this is the house where I lived in it. This is the house where the like 10 gays on campus live. And so my rural Indiana
take care of each other,
met a queer person in Austin and was like, I got it. I gotta be best friends with this dude. Like, I gotta figure out what he's doing, how to do what he's doing, and like get into his community. And so I found out that he performed and taught at one of the theaters in town. And so I signed up for a class because I was like, this is what the gay person in Austin does. This is what I'm gonna do.
Oh, man. You know, the improv community is so happy to hear that. The Austin improv community is so happy to hear that somebody felt like they were included as a queer person in improv, because there's so much stuff that we're working on right now to try to do more diversity and inclusion, to the point where it was like, God, have we been terrible to everyone every minute all the time? So I'm glad to hear that you were like, oh, I found a great person and we connected on being queer and then we connected on improv. So,
yeah,
man, that's so nice. That's so nice. Where did you start? What was the theater?
I started at the Hideout.
Nice. Nice.
Yeah. So I was taking that, and I think the reason I continued was because I found how beneficial it was for my teaching. But I definitely started because I found another gay person.
Sure, sure. Were you able to stay connected with that friend? Like,
I am, yeah. Right. We've taught together. He performed in my birthday show a couple of years ago. We did medieval queers. So we did an improvised, like, there were, like, gay knights and polyamorous princesses. And
beautiful. So
beautiful
fun.
Time.
Yeah, absolutely. So good. For your birthday. That's so fun.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I love that. And the Hideout is a lovely community, very welcoming and sweet. So that's a great place to start in town and a good spot to, you know, meet supportive friends.
And the only theater so the reason I picked the Hideout, one was because this guy that I had met worked there, but it was also the only theater that had anything about disability on their website in terms of programming. So the Hideout does the Building Connections program, which is classes for kids with disabilities. And so I thought, okay, this is the only theater that's showing me they care about accessibility at all. I have no idea about all these other ones, how ableist they're going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. As far as, you know, this is an important thing for you, but was this because of your own experience with MS that you wanted to make sure there was this inclusiveness, or was it based on the education that you had learned? You know, you'd done all this studying on how people learn.
Right.
And I'm sure in that research, you're seeing that, like, you know, disabled people have a totally fine ability to learn things and we're all just discounting them. So,
yeah. So my history with disability goes back pretty far because my brother is disabled. So my brother has epilepsy and has been involved in the special education system since he was 4. And so growing up, I saw a lot of, like, my mom navigating the system and going to IEP meetings and going to doctor's visits and all sorts of like that side of the system is what I saw growing up. And that gave me a really deep kind of like understanding and passion for supporting people going through that system, because it is really hard.
Yeah. 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 Ain't nobody helping them. I've noticed a lot of stuff since now that we're like well into COVID. I've noticed some people talking about how it's like, isn't it interesting? You know, I hope we've all noticed the ableism that's out there, such that we've adjusted the whole world to a thing that could have been helpful to people for many, many years. But we're told, no, you can't work from home, or no, right, we can't do this, or, oh, that'd be too difficult. No one's ever going to live stream that. It's like, or now everyone will, all the time, forever. Like, if you think you're going to a conference, like, conferences might go back to in person, but if you think any conference ever is not going to be live streamed, you're wrong. Like, all will.
On the one hand, it's like, I think that conversation is really hard for me personally to have, because on the one hand, it's like, this is great. This is an improvement. A lot more people are going to get access. And on the other hand, it's like, why couldn't you have listened to us earlier?
Yeah.
When we said that, right? Like, why did it take you being personally affected for you to care?
You know, I wonder, is there anything in your educational research that answers why people have a tendency to only be able to truly understand something when they firsthand knowledge of it? I mean, because you're right. That's exactly how people are. If it doesn't have, it's like all everything that's come up during COVID, like privilege, like racism, all sorts of things are people where people are like, well, I don't do it, or I've never seen it. So, and you're like, okay, cool. That's great. But here's the thing. The whole world is different. And like we were talking about way earlier, this idea of having empathy for the way other people exist in the world, right? And bringing it back to that idea, like,
so a lot of this is reminding me of, I took a class on narrative inquiry methods, which is like qualitative research, like interview research. We spent a portion of that talking about identity theory and what makes up a person and all the different facets of our identities, right? You know, we have like everything from like being an artist and a teacher to what like race you are and what culture you come from. And I think when I hear this question, a lot of what comes up for me is the difference in like individualist versus more communal or collective cultures, right? Like America, particularly white America, has a very nuclear individualist culture, which makes it so that you grow up feeling like very independent, like in control, like autonomous, in control of your own actions, and other people should be in control of yours. And I think it's really harmful, honestly, our individualist culture. Mm. And we know from the research that like people who are oppressed in this country have more collectivist cultures, right? Like people in low-income communities show a lot more community support because they don't have the like resources to be able to do things individually. So when I hear that, my question is, are all those people like affluent white people?
Yeah, it's hard to know. It's hard to know what way. That's a really smart point of view, that idea of the individualist culture. You know, I was just talking to somebody, my like last guest, so I guess when this comes out, the last week's guest, we were talking about the idea of communication and how different countries, different cultures have a different way of processing communication. Like either they offer you something or they listen to you, but usually it's one or the other. And I feel like it's interesting how with the individualist thing, it's more like, this is my thing and I'm going to tell you about it and show you how I'm doing okay. Almost like the entire existence of Facebook is like American culture for sure. And then other people in more community-based groups are more into listening, not always necessarily because they're like dying to listen, but because there's 47 people that have to talk, so you kind of have to spend some time listening. So I don't know. I mean, there's something after whoever's doing their grad school project listening to my interviews will really be finding some interesting pathways when it comes to, you know, how we can communicate, how we can try to see outside of ourselves. You know, thankfully, the one thing that to bring back what we were talking about, creative people have a tendency to be able to feel a breadth of emotion that others do not. And I feel like also there's a larger capacity for empathy. Does it swing other ways? Do people go egomaniacal? Yeah, there's always the swing, for sure. But I feel like it's kind of like, you know, there's this group that wants to connect, and that's what artists, you know, people who are artists in their soul, you know, like I feel that from you, you know what I mean? Like we're talking about, you know, a few classes at Hideout, but you're deeply entrenched in the community. You know what I mean? Like we, like I said, we met through a community group, mm-hmm. like, and yeah, improv is great.
That wasn't even the Hideout. It was a different one. Yeah. I don't, yeah. like people ask me what my home theater is and I say, I don't have one. Like my role is to, at least as an adult, right? So I kind of parse my performing identity in like a couple of ways, but like as an adult, my role is to just make art that serves my needs and my community's needs, and it doesn't have to belong to a specific home.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. There's something to the way that I feel like pre-COVID, even still, there were separations in even just the Austin improv community. You and I are from the same community. I talk to people all over the world about their communities, but you and I have the same one. So there was definitely separate schools, no quote unquote competition, but definitely differences that we status, acknowledged yeah. and were like, and yeah, and status, different things where it was like, oh, well, I did this. Oh, okay. You know, that kind of stuff. Whereas now, when we went dark, when everyone closed, everyone started talking to each other and groups have started to combine. And like you said, take care of each other. We were marginalized because we were told all you want to do is be on stage. P.S. You can never be on stage for a year and a half. Like yeah. you cannot do it. And so now everyone's trying to take care of each other like that we normally would in the community. Like we'd see each other at rehearsals or like in the halls or like going from show to show or whatever. And you'd be checking on your friends. How you doing? Hey man, looks like you need a sandwich, like different things where you're like yeah. taking care of your friends visually. You're like looking at them, you're being with them. And that's a lot of what I'm older, certainly than you, but like also a lot of the improv community, not like worldwide, but like I find that when I go into an improv community, I'm, you know, the older woman and there's like mostly people in their 20s and early 30s. You know yeah. what I mean? It kind of what we were talking about before we started recording, this idea that like I'm holding on. I'm going to be doing this. This is my thing. Like yeah. other people are like, oh, I took an improv class and now I'm a lawyer. And I'm like, cool. I'm still an improv teacher. Like that's what I want to do. It's fun. But like the journey of it and how it gets developed. I'm going to bring it back to you. Because I feel like there's something really interesting about your experience in the community and how it feels for you for the Austin improv community. I also love the idea that like you have mostly have only taken classes at like one theater, but
I have taken classes at other theaters.
Oh, oh.
I did all of Merlin Works's programming, took a level one at Fallout and a level one at the Institution, and I'm in the technically like the longest advanced studies program that Cold Town has ever done, because we've just been perpetually in the last section of it since COVID.
That's wild. Yeah, because the last section is doing a show, right? You can't do a show.
Yeah. So we've just been in there. Yeah. But yeah, no, I mean, that's part of why I think I feel that way, because I've gained so much from each of the different schools. Yeah, and I use
that is
them.
A lot.
Yeah, and I use them in my, I teach with the Building Connections program now, which I also think this is hilarious, because true to Elena fashion, I started taking improv classes in August and started volunteering with the Building Connections program that same semester, right? And within a year, I was lead teaching, right? Like,
yeah.
The next semester, they asked me to be the assistant, and then I was like, suddenly I felt like such an imposter for a while, because I was like, holy shit, I've been doing improv for like 2 years and I've been teaching it for a year now.
I mean, are you kidding me? I went directly from graduating my level 5 class into teaching a level 1 class. Like
there you
directly.
Go. Yeah. So yeah, I think that's my thought about it is, in general, is that there's a lot of hierarchy that I'm very averse to. I don't like hierarchy at all. And so I just try to like take the things that I want and make it so that anyone can access things and anyone can improvise, which I firmly believe. I believe anyone can improvise.
I believe that as well. I think that that is also correct. That is something that I tell people every time that we do it. I was like, all right, I'd like to dispel a notion for you in your brain right now. You're in this room and you're like, I wonder if I can do this. Everyone can do this. This is not a wild skill that is unusual to people. I'm literally tapping you back into a childhood skill that you have. And it's just like finding it for yourself and accessing that part of your brain. We use so little. I'm trying to show you how to use an extra part.
Yeah. Well, and so many of us, we're improvising our conversations.
Yeah.
All the time.
Totally. I go, just say words. And they're like, what do you mean? I was like, you and me just now, we had a scene. It was about how you weren't sure what to do.
Yeah.
Like, it's okay. Anything is fine. Especially the first day, they're like, what do I do a scene about? I was like, you guys have never met. Have it talk.
Yeah.
I was like, meet each other.
Yeah. Like, there's, I mean, you can train to do more theatrical scenes or like more play-like improv or whatever. But at the base of it, like anything you do on a stage is a thing that a human can do.
Well, you have to I teach level one and you have to dispel the notion from their brain that they can't do it. And that's the first two classes.
Yeah.
Like everyone comes in going, I'm going to try this, but I'm probably not going to be any good at it. Every person. Right. And you're like, and so my job is to just be like, you know, the warm teddy bear that goes like, it's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. You know? And in fact, I'm dying to know if that's the correct educational point of view. Oh God. Your knowledge is so like fascinating to me. My, the thing for me, I haven't performed in a while, you know, since I had the baby, I just haven't gone to the theater and, you know, after, you know, drama with the theater and whatnot, I kind of stepped back and then I've been easing back in with teaching. And I find teaching sometimes to be more creative than even performing.
Yes. You know? Yes. This is my favorite.
Yeah. I mean, I just think that it's like instead of doing a show for an audience, A, I'm doing a show for the students, but also I am trying to literally interact with all of them, almost like in an improv troupe where you've got like six or seven other people in the troupe and you have to connect with all of them to make sure that you're all like on point together. I feel like that when I'm teaching like a class, like I'm like checking in on each one of them and I'm like, you doing okay? How's it going? And everybody's learning at different levels and you have to reassure them when they're not at the same level all the time, you know. So I just find it so it's like so many more balls to juggle than even just, you know, when people are like, it's so scary to like go up on stage and like just talk without knowing what I'm gonna say. I was like, you know what's even crazier is talking to 20 of you and trying to figure out what you all want and give it to you. Like,
I think it's the pressure that, at least for me, it sounds like maybe for you too, the pressure you're under makes you have to be more creative. And I definitely feel that. Like, I feel like my most like ingenious improvised moments occur when I'm trying to use improv as a tool to support a child. Right. It's like very small example. I was in my preschool a couple of years ago and there was this kid who didn't want to go back into his classroom. They were playing out in the big room for a while because we had this like rotating thing where each classroom got a turn to play in the big room and then they would go back to their classroom. And this kiddo didn't want to go back. The big room was set up as a campfire and with like a little tent. And so he was hiding in the tent and was like, his teacher was like, come into the classroom. He was like, no. And so I was like, I'll help him. So his teacher goes back in the classroom with all the, you know, like 10 other kids or whatever. And I sit down next to this kid and I hand him a fake marshmallow. And I say, hey, will you roast this marshmallow with me? And he says, yeah. And he roasts the marshmallow. And then I say, you know, this marshmallow smells really good. I think your teacher might like to try a bite of it. Should we go give her a bite of this marshmallow? And he immediately gets this huge smile on his face, starts like shaking his head yes, like jumps out of the tent, walks back into his classroom, gives her the pretend marshmallow, and then all is fine.
Yeah.
And like, I could have, you know, continued to like tell that kid, like, you have to do this. We're going inside now. You have to do this. Or we could just like make s'mores and then it's fine.
Yeah.
No, it's so much easier and more fun to do it through play.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like improv classes for adults are trying to tap into that.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to reconnect with the freedom that is allowing yourself to have your mind changed with a game.
Yeah.
Because we have so many roadblocks in our own heads stopping us. And little kids do too, but they're more open to games and playing and whatnot.
And they don't have so much social filter built up.
Yeah. Filter gets.
I'm still learning. I don't know how to teach adults very well. I'm still learning.
Interesting. If you ever, when you teach adults, just treat them the same as the kids and it'll be fine.
Yeah.
I mean, they need it too. People don't care about adults the way they care about kids. So sometimes they need some care.
I have thought about that because I've taught a couple of workshops just on like inclusive physicality. Because that's kind of my like niche in improv is physicality. I'm a dancer. Right. And so I do well. Yeah, I'm a circus dancer. Just like.
Wow, that didn't come up at all. What?
Yeah, no. Yeah, I do trapeze and rope and all of that sort of. I know it's because you get me on this thing and I'm like, these are the 17 hobbies that I have. So I'm a disabled circus artist and I teach inclusive physicality workshops to adult improvisers. And I still feel very anxious doing it because it's so different with adults, like not being able to read their expressions the same way as I can a 3-year-old. But I have thought about that, about like doing a, like, this is just a children's class. It's completely the same way I would teach a children's class, but you adults are invited. I want to do that.
Don't tell them that's what's going to happen.
No, I can't tell. Okay.
No. The adults cannot. No. Mm-mm.
Well, if you're listening to this podcast,
do this workshop twice. Do this workshop twice. The people who are listening at this point, like if they're listening all the way through to the end, these are your best friends. These are my best friends. They'll take the workshop no matter what happens. Don't worry. I was like, people who listen all the way to the end care. So don't worry. They got our back. My suggestion would be do it once. Without telling anyone what it's going to be, right? Tell them, you know, whatever buzzwords that you would use, like things that they can learn. You're going to tap into your inner child, blah, 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 any of it.
Mm-hmm.
But after the first time, people will talk. And so you can't keep it a secret anymore. But try it once because that reaction of how different it is and like how overly playful it could be. If they're expecting it and they think of it as they have to tap into their inner child in some way, there are more roadblocks because then they're like, I don't understand children. I don't know. And they're not going to take it.
Yeah.
But if you like tell them that they're going to work on like, you know, teamwork and collaboration, then like they'll take it. And then you'll be doing like childlike stuff. And they're like, wait,
yeah.
I understand. Yeah,
I think it's trick them.
Well, no, not trick them. It's just sometimes, and maybe you can tell me I'm incorrect. I find that for me, with educating something that people are often reticent to learn improv. They take the class, but sometimes they're holding themselves back, and so I can't tell them what I'm teaching them. I have to show them something and then let them learn something and then go, see, the reason why I did this exercise was XYZ, right?
Yep.
And maybe that's what they got out of it. But oftentimes they get something different out of it, or only a few of them get it out of it. It's almost like the math brain idea that we were talking about. People process information differently, right? So I present this idea to them and then they take it in different ways.
Right. And, as a facilitator, you offer different practices and your job is to help them figure out how to make meaning out of it.
Right.
So like, that's why you can't say, don't ask questions in the first, you know, 101 class that you take. But you have to instead say, like, you know, do this exercise where you only ask questions. Okay, how did that feel? Let's like make meaning out of it in our reflection afterward.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, people are like, why didn't you stop him from putting his foot in his mouth? And I was like, well, I wanted him to put his foot in his mouth. And then everybody reacted. And I was like, how'd that go?
It's a natural consequence. We talk about that in early childhood all the time.
Yeah.
Oh, I was telling this to a friend the other day, about how much design goes into just the placement of furniture around a preschool classroom. Because if there's a wide open path, like across the classroom, every 3-year-old is going to try to run down it. And I can tell them, you know, use your walking feet, I can tell them that all day. Or I can put a bookshelf that divides the room in half in the middle of the path. None of those 3-year-olds are going to run into that bookshelf twice. They're not doing it. Like, it's a natural consequence. And that's what you did for that improviser. You provided a natural consequence that they're not probably not going to do that same joke at least twice.
Man, that also just made me think of a day job I had one time. And it was like open setup. Like, it was just a big open space with desks, but it felt too open and no one ever got anything done. We were always just like socializing with each other. And they were always like, can you guys stop? It was like, we're all just kind of here. Like, there's just not. Yeah. Interesting. Oh, man. You're even bringing your engineering stuff in, right? Like organizing, keeping this kind of stuff. Man, you've blown my mind when it comes to all of this education stuff. So, I mean, I'm super fascinated by how, you know, what you've learned, kid, you know, has made you a better teacher. And then, you know, how I can soak it up while talking to you for an hour and a half. I mean, let's be clear. It's all about me. Just kidding. Not really. But the thing I want to talk to you about as a like final question is about your creative hobbies. You mentioned all of these amazing creative hobbies, right?
Mm-hmm.
As we've talked about, you know, the community that we're a part of, the improv community, doesn't have as much going on as it did. We're not out multiple nights a week, going to classes, going to shows, doing different things. It's a bit more like we all have to create our own projects. So I wondered, like, what is the creative thing that's exciting you right now? What's the thing where a year into the pandemic shutdown, there hasn't been theater in a full year. Like, what are you doing to fill that need?
Yeah, absolutely. So I set creative goals each year. So I did that in January. One of my goals for this month, I just looked at it a couple days ago, is to write 2 songs. Like, I've written like 1 song before in my life. Right now I'll like go out into the woods and like improvise music and like take videos of myself doing it. And I'm trying to figure out how to extract a song out of that. So that's one thing. I also dance every day and I post a video of it to Facebook. I'm trying to do a bunch of different songs to it. Most recently, this happened the other day where usually my thing with creativity is, if I have a calling for it, then I will find out how to do it, right? That's why I do so many different things, because I just follow my intuition. And so the most recent thing that I want to do is I pole dance, and I have a pole in my house. that's how I've been doing my like aerial workouts in the quarantine, is that I've been working out on my pole. And I listened to Montero by Lil Nas X. And now all I want to do is create an extended, like, 3.5-minute pole routine to the whole song. It's going to be so gay. I've got a rainbow flag that is like behind my pole. that it permanently lives behind my pole. It's, like, it's going to be so gay.
I'm so excited. That's so great. You have such joy. Like, you just so, your face is so filled with joy. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's wonderful. These are great. Man, you're, what's really great about talking to you is the, like, so much energy. Like, you have so much energy to, like, try all these things. You've, like, been so voracious since you were a child of, like, you know, getting all the education as quickly as you could, moving forward with your life, like, learning how people learn. Like, how meta is that? Yeah. Like, and then you, like, deep dive into it and really use it in the most intense possible way. I think that that is such a great use for a creative mind, for a creative spirit, because, you know, education can be tough, especially, you know, in the world of teachers aren't really the most well taken care of in our society. Yes. Like, it, to have somebody who cares so deeply about not just teaching, but the process of teaching and, like, how we can be, like, working smarter, not harder, like, just such, so inspiring to me. Like, again, I'm telling you, write this book. You will be a billionaire. Oh, man. But you, it's been really great to talk to you. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. I just really appreciate having this conversation with you.
Aw, thank you, Amy. It's been so nice to talk with you for a while.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.